So I'm going to go ahead and start because I don't really need a projector because, well, I kind of do to illustrate some things, but I think I could talk my way through it anyway. So my name is Matt, and my handle is spelled S-Y-K-E, and I'm a member of New Hack City, which is a hacker collective in San Francisco. And Jeru, which is he's right here, he's also going to attempt to speak, hopefully with a video projector in place of some kind. What else can I say? So I worked for 2 years for a commercial vendor of security software. It doesn't really matter which one, and I prefer not to say because I'd hate to think that people think their products are better because of my knowledge in any way. We have T-shirts for sale out there, and I'm going to be giving out T-shirts. New Hack has already sold out before anyone even knew who they really were. We figured we'd just jump the gun. I think the inspiration was AtStake selling out so fast, or Loft selling out to AtStake so fast. So here's the basic deal, is that there's four major areas I'm going to cover. And I posted an outline to, or Jeff posted my outline to the DEF CON webpage, and I've changed it a little bit since then because I thought it would be a little bit more interesting to look at things a bit from a bit more holistic perspective. So I'm going to cover four areas, and those four areas are what user expectations of IDSs and firewalls are, like why do people buy these things in the first place, and then the second thing is how to test for those expectations to make sure that people are getting what they want hypothetically, and then the third section is common coding problems that sort of come up, that sort of bubble to the surface when you actually start doing this kind of testing. And then the fourth thing is what designers and people who are writing these things like right now, like from scratch, can do to avoid a lot of the mistakes that I have seen in the last couple years, code-wise and design-wise. So the first thing is users. Why do people buy IDSs and firewalls? And like, why is it such a popular market right now? And like the last year, it's up to a couple $1 billion or something. It's like crazy that people are actually paying money for this stuff. Well, I think the main reason is people basically don't care. Users really don't care if a proxy firewall or a packet filtering based firewall or a hybrid firewall is going to make them more safe, or if a network-based IDS or a host-based IDS is going to make them more safe. All that they care about is they have a topology and an infrastructure they don't want to change, and they will put in whatever is going to fit in what they have right now. Whatever is the easiest thing to implement is what they're going to end up implementing. And that's basically what it comes down to. So this talk has nothing to do with arguing over which is better or any of this complete nonsense. So because you have to make both, because people want both or need both or have been convinced that they want or need both kinds, in either the firewall or the IDS space. So yeah, people just want to deploy and not have to deal with anything. I think most people actually are aware that IDSs don't make you safe. I'm pretty confident of this. A lot of hacksaws and like security consultants or whatever think that like general, I don't know if you call them consumers or not, think that IDSs make you more safe somehow. IDSs just give you time to react, and that's all that they do. And I think that most people are aware of this. I think that most people don't think that IDSs are going to magically stop you from being attacked. So I don't think that there's a misperception there. Firewalls, this is kind of weird, because real purists will say, you know, firewalls and IDSs are fluff and crap, and they just need to fix the real problems and, like, make the code in the OSs better and in the FTP daemons and whatever. That's not really practical. So from a certain standpoint, firewalls do help you reduce and manage risk, right? If the firewalls are implemented properly in both code and topology, right? If the coding is solid, like they've done everything properly, and you've deployed it properly in your infrastructure, and you've configured it properly and everything, hypothetically speaking, it will reduce, like, the ways people can get in, hypothetically. Although we've all seen like the hacking exposed things that Ernst & Young and those guys did, where like all they need is port 80, and then they bounce in and do a port 139 redirect and using Netcat and like all kinds of crazy shit. So, but hypothetically, from a certain perspective, it does reduce risk. And so vendors have convinced people, of course, that since some bullshit percent number, let's say 80% of all intrusions come internally, and your firewall isn't going to protect you from those, you need to have an IDS anyway. So you need to have your IDS to protect you from the outside problems, and you need an IDS to protect you from the problems that the firewall can't block or you just can't deal with or whatever. Okay, so people expect firewalls to keep packets out, and people expect IDSs to tell them when they're being attacked with whatever signatures. Oh my God, is that a video projector? Be still my heart. So this is what people are expecting. So section two, how do you test for these expectations? I have three favorite tools, basically. They are Nmap, Whisker, and ISIC. And ISIC is a suite of utilities. And I think Mike Franson, who ISIC is here, he's right there. This guy is the bomb shit right here. This guy's tools have helped me find so many bugs. We released a new hack, released a NetBSD advisory 2 months ago or something. Where? Yes, you do get a T-shirt. I promise. Here's a T-shirt. Oh, by the way, here's what they look like. ASCII art. New York City logo at the bottom. Let me see if I can throw it that far, right? Pretty close. There you go. So Nmap, Whisker, and ISIC. Basically, here's the deal. You can't just download these tools and start using them and like think you're going to find shit. Please understand what these tools are doing. Like, even if you can't read code, read the docs and like figure it out. I don't think I'm that smart, and yet like I can like sort of like know how this stuff works. And if you actually read the docs and understand how it works, you'll understand that when you're using ISIC or ESIC, that you should disconnect yourself from like public networks so that you don't like DOS every box on like the subnet plus, which people still do. Yes? ISIC? Oh, I'm sorry. It's IP Stack Integrity Checker. And it's actually a suite of utilities. And I'm going to go through each of them individually and how they should be used. And I'll say the URLs at the end. It's really pathetic. I have all these URLs memorized. Understand the tools. Okay. What the fuck is that? That's odd. Okay. What do the tools do? I'm glad you asked. I think everyone knows what Nmap is. I think it's pretty ridiculous how popular Nmap is and how much everyone uses it for everything, and how every time you go on an IRC channel, someone says, "You're running NetBSD!" And it's like, well, that's great. Thanks for telling me something I didn't know. So Nmap is really good, not as a port scanner or anything like that. Nmap is really cool for testing a couple of things in firewalls and IDSs. In state-based packet filtering firewalls and NAT implementations, and even IPsec tunnel implementations, Nmap is really, it's so simple. It's really elegant. Just like doing a port scan through like a trusted tunnel, like a fin scan or something, and then, you know, watch like the IPsec implementation and then like take a shit. All these tools, by the way, are like the focus is firewalls and IDSs, but testing IPsec tunnels, like if you go to your VPN bake-offs in like your area or whatever, take these tools with you. Whisker, not so much, but like ISIC especially. Holy shit. ISIC found so many things, so many bugs in IPsec implementations, it's not even funny. So anyway, Nmap. So just doing a simple port scan with Nmap will usually suffice. So because I don't have my slides and my pretty pictures, I'm going to use my hands. So I have a untrusted network, the big bad internet over here. I have my firewall IDS, you know, whatever the fuck. And then I have my trusted machines that are protected by the firewall and whatever else. So an interesting thing to do is to run an Nmap scan through all 65,535 ports. Just to really like give like the state table. Well, should I explain this? So in an IDS, like when you make a connection, when you send a SYN, like there's a state table structure generally. I don't know if everyone's implemented this the same way, but I don't know how else you do it. There's a state table structure, then it adds your source and the destination, like this. Yes? Oh my goodness. All right. Where is that at? Right here? Awesome. Oh. What? Do you actually expect me to use Star Office? Yeah. Whatever. Introduction, rundown, user expectations, testing for blah. Most users are aware. Most should have both anyway. Nmap Whisker. Oh, I'm sorry. So I'll start here. So here's this. So Nmap Whisker, ISIC, IPsec Integrity Checker. Don't just use these tools blindly. Understand how the fuck they work. Otherwise, like, your testing means dick, and you post a security focus like an idiot, or post a bug track like an idiot. Like, you know, I ran Nmap 1,000 times, and then when I came back in the morning, the box crashed. That doesn't help anybody. It really doesn't. Or the vendor's like, well, what was your configuration? It's like, I wiped the box already. Like, you really aren't helping anybody trying to solve the problem that you've found. Configuration can make a difference, especially on firewalls. Like, let's say that you do an Nmap test or you run TCP-SYC, route it through the firewall, and you have one deny rule. I've seen situations where you add an allow rule or you add an absorb rule or whatever, or you add two deny rules or something, and then the machine will crash or then it'll leak packets or what have you. So if you're really interested in, like, finding problems and stuff, just be really diligent if you have the time and the resources and whatever. So here's the network ID or idea. Untrusted, you have your target machine, which is your firewall, and then you have your trusted network. And so usually in my examples, I say go from untrusted to trusted because that's usually what people do when they're doing penetration testing. But if you're looking for crashes or packet leakage or whatever, you can find it the other way as well. And people usually miss this. I found a couple of bugs in the software I was testing just going the other way around, especially with NAT. If you have a NATed firewall or IP masqueraded or River Links, people call it, and you send like the other way instead of you send like from trusted to untrusted instead of the other way around, that gives the code that maintains the state tables for NAT a really good workout. I'll give you an example of a bug that I found that worked like that. When you sent FIN packets through NAT from trusted to untrusted, the firewall made an entry in the state table for that FIN and then never removed it, ever. So if you did a FIN scan or flooded it with FINs or what have you, with like from random source addresses, basically you're testing to see if there's any unchecked mallocs. And if there's an unchecked malloc and usually the stuff is in ring zero, you've got a blue screen or an oops or whatever Linux calls it, or a kernel panic or what have you. Whose firewall is what? It doesn't matter, it's been fixed. Next. Right. Okay, so Nmap. State table code and packet filter and NAT implementations. From an untrusted machine, Netmap, Nmap, SYN scan, ports 1 through 65,535. A really cool thing to do, by the way, that Nmap won't let you do is send stuff on port 0 through a firewall. That gets interesting results sometimes. Same way with through an IPsec tunnel, et cetera, et cetera. And so what you can see when you do this, if you know how to look, by the way, if anyone knows how to see non-paged kernel memory usage in Linux, could you please tell me, either programmatically or otherwise, because I couldn't find any information on the net at all on how to do it. But if you were able to do that, like you are on NT in about 1 second, what you'd see is that when you do that, you see non-page kernel memory increase because what's happening is the state table is growing because you're doing a lot of connections. And so, like I said, what this tests for is one unchecked malloc. Like most operating systems impose a hard limit on non-page kernel memory, like 16 meg or 20 meg or however much it is. I think it depends on how much physical RAM you have. For you non-OS architecture people, non-page kernel memory is... non-page kernel memory is memory only accessible to the kernel that never gets paged out, ever. Because if it gets, because for whatever reason, the data structure that's holding it couldn't handle like a virtual memory fault or a page fault of any kind. And state tables happen to fall into this sort of category. And so if you make the state table grow large enough, eventually it's going to hit that hard limit of non-page kernel memory. The OS is going to say, sorry, right? And I've seen it time and time and time again where I don't know why, but people don't check the return values of syscalls, not just malloc, although malloc is like the most common, or in all the other alloc calls as well. There's been a couple vulnerabilities now, like people weren't checking the return of set GID, like if that failed and like defaulted to zero or something. I think it was in Woo or something. It's the AfroPic show. So that's basically what you're testing. And if you're looking for stuff like that, like you're like looking for DOSs where they run out of memory and then they fuck up because they didn't check a malloc somewhere. Both in Linux and in NT, and probably BSD as well, you can limit the amount of physical memory the OS will use. That will help you greatly in finding these bugs faster. Because if you're doing this on a 128 meg machine, you really have to beat the living fuck out of it in order to like get it to crash or do whatever you're trying to get it to do. And so if you just kind of lower it just a little bit, you'll hit these conditions a lot easier. Wait, I don't want to go to Whisker. What the fuck? Go back home. There we go. Different scan types, like I said, thin packet and a certain implementation of a stateful packet filter firewall didn't remove fins if you just sent a fin. It was really odd. I don't know how the thing ever worked. It probably did never work, but axe scans, et cetera, et cetera. So tiny IP frags. This used to be an interesting way to leak packets through firewalls and to make firewalls crash because... For a stateful packet filter-based firewall, god damn it, it's hot. Wow. For a stateful packet filter to do its job properly, if I've blocked port 80, I'm going to assume some knowledge of TCP IP here. If I block port 80 and the TCP header is split up across multiple IP packets, right? So when I get my first IP packet on the firewall and I'm analyzing it and I'm looking at it, and I say, okay, is this allowed on the ports that I'm allowing to pass through me? Like, well, I can't see the port because that port information in the TCP header is in the next IP fragment. You can do one of two things if you're an implementer. You can either reassemble until you get the full TCP header, in which case you're opening yourself to DOSs with memory usage, with people sending a whole lot of frags and you're holding them waiting for the next fragment to come so you can get the full header. Or you can just drop them. I would recommend dropping them because... the likelihood that an MTU is that small, that a TCP header would be split across IP packets, is very, 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 very unlikely. In fact, if anyone can tell me a configuration in which that would really happen, I'd really like to hear it. So if you're an implementer, drop tiny IP frags. Don't even fuck with them. It's not even worth any trouble because it doesn't happen in real life. If someone sends you tiny IP frags, they're fucking with you, period. So the neat thing Tiny IP Frags does now is that state-based IDSs that keep track of connections and whatever else, if your IDS is like a logic tree, like they're not just doing flat sort of packet grepping, and they actually check to see that, okay, there's a SYN, all right, there's an ACK, okay, and then I look for my get PHF, right? IDSs that do stuff like that are actually, you can actually, this sort of stuff kind of works. Because for IDSs that don't do IP fragmentation reassembly, like, it has the same problem that the state-based packet filtering firewalls do, in that they can't get the full state with the first packet. So it's like, what do I do? I can't do reassembly either, so I guess I'm just not going to pay attention to this stream unless it matches, like, my packet gripping. And because you're fragmenting that small anyway, it doesn't really matter. And you can do tiny IP frags with another tool that I almost mentioned called FragRouter. And FragRouter is a fine tool. I think it's written by Doug Song. Maybe he's here. That can send tiny IP frags with just regular traffic. It works just like it sounds. It's a router that fragments packets to whatever interesting configuration you want. So, SYNSCAN port one, like all the ports basically, doing a full port sweep, like expands and contracts state tables if they're implemented properly. So, this is pretty evil because this next example here, nmap, SYNSCAN, all the ports, decoy scan. I love decoy scan. Let me tell you why I love decoy scan. And with decoy scan, you can fill up state tables faster than anything. And I really like using really fucked up addresses for the decoy scan, which if you're one or two hops away, you could probably get away with, but it might not be practical. Can I go back one? So see here, this network here is 192.168.2, and the one I'm sending from is 10.0.0. Can you go back again? Forward one. Huh? Oh, thanks. Does it work? No? This thing here? Yeah. So I'm using the loopback address of the destination network, the broadcast address of the destination network, and then the loopback and the broadcast of my network, and then just crazy shit like, you know, 255.255.255.255 and 0.0.0.0. I've found interesting packet leakage problems doing stuff like this. Whether or not these packets can be routed through the actual internet is a whole nother question. But, I mean, if someone owns your ISP and they're one hop away, it's a completely feasible scenario. So decoy scans are actually pretty neat. And actually, I don't think that they're really useful for evading IDS detection at all, because that's what the original purpose was that you do so many parallel scans that the IDS logs flood and they can't tell what's going on because they see so many source addresses for the port scans and they can't tell which one's the real one. So nmap can be gotten from http://insecure.org/nmap. I think everyone knows that. Whoever doesn't know that shouldn't be here. Next. Whisker. Whisker is really cool. It's written in Perl, so you can just run it on Win32 or Linux or BSD or whatever the fuck runs Perl. Probably your Palm Pilot can run Whisker if it runs Perl. Yes, sir? I'm sorry. All right. That would be nice. Do what? Turn up the volume, like this. Yeah. All right. So I think everyone knows what Whisker is. Basically made to is a HTTP scanner, but Rainforest Puppy, bless his heart, add a whole bunch of IDS evasion functionality, which is really cool. If you see him, give him a big hug and a smooch because he really deserves it. Because this gets past these things. I think I haven't seen an IDS that one of those evasion techniques does not get past. If you can show me one, I'll blow you or something. So Whisker basically what? Oh, thank you. Let me take a drink real quick. So Whisker works like this. You have Perl installed, or you have Perl installed. I'm sorry. You have Perl installed. It's just Whisker -H your target host, and then Dash I goes through all of the various IDS evasion techniques. Dash I one is URL encoding, which is a very popular one to do, which what's-his-face, Robert Graham from Network Ice blasted Network Associates' CyberCop monitor for not doing when it really does. So I think everyone knows, like, Whisker is good for doing this stuff, but here's the interesting point that I don't think anybody has thought of is HTTP proxies are blocked by URL. Like, they block, like anything where fuck is in the URL or something. How much you want to bet that they're all susceptible to URL encoding? I bet you that they all are. So a lot of people think proxies are just deployed so that users on the inside can browse the web through this proxy. Well, actually, sometimes it works the other way around. Well, they'll have a proxy so that people coming in from the outside, like, are limited access unless they belong to certain URLs, unless they belong to a certain IP range or something like that, or they authenticate first. This gets past that. Something else to test for in HTTP proxies. I'm not going to talk too much about this because Whisker has great docs. Everyone knows what the hell it is and knows what it does and knows what its capabilities are. So the URL is http://www.wiretrip.net/RFP. Then you can go in there and choose your theme and then find the Whisker docs. That's www.wiretrip.net/RFP for Rainforest Puppy. ISIC, okay. I'm sorry. I can't get over it. These are my favorite tools ever for testing this kind of stuff. It's not necessarily a new idea. It's just somebody finally did it. ISIC is a suite of utilities. There's ISIC, which is IP Stack Integrity Checker. TCPSIC is TCP Stack Integrity Checker. UDP is UDP, and ICMP is ICMP. And ESIC is Ethernet, which is actually really cool. We found some interesting problems with that that we'll probably release sometime in the next millennia, hopefully. Great for testing protocol implementations on all of these. Like I said, we found the NetBSD bug, the remote crash, with an ICMP packet it was an ICMP packet. It was unaligned IP options caused an unaligned memory access it stopped working. There it goes. Using ICMPSIC, and the steps for it to reproduce were in the advisory. ISIC, all the utilities are used libnet by route, which is also a great library. Beautiful code to read if you're into that kind of thing. State-based IDSs and packet filters. Basically, what these tools do is they send sort of controlled random packets. It's kind of interesting. So basically, you seed it with a random seed. Remember in all your basic stuff when you would use rand and you have to seed it with like 32k to negative 32k? Works kind of like that. And so basically, if you enter the same random seed, you'll get the same random results. And it, does IP options. It changes all the IP options. It changes the length, changes the header length, lies about the header length, all kinds of crazy shit. Basically, it throws a lot. It just pukes all over the protocol stack and sees if the protocol stack can take it. Because state-based IDSs and packet filters are sort of kind of implementations of TCP/IP to an extent. God, it's hot. Our implementation of TCP/IP to an extent, this sort of vomiting works as well. It's just like Nmap with the state-based IDS, where from a certain IP, I go SYN, and then wait a minute, I don't get an ACK, I get a FIN immediately, and oh god, I'm screwed and I puke. Same way with state-based firewalls, small IP packets, not necessarily tiny IP frags, certain fragment offsets. That's what else this is good at finding, is some things are sensitive to just certain fragment offsets. And if you run these tools for long enough, eventually you'll hit all of them. IPsec tunnels, same thing. In fact, Hugh Daniel and I talked about this a couple months ago. I don't know if he's done it yet, But he used to take HPing, some utility called HPing, to VPN bake-offs and try and get other people's IPsec implementations to crash at the bake-offs. And I pointed him at Isaac, and I don't know if he's actually used it yet. I really hope he does, because I'm sure that it'll just make a whole lot of people's IPsec implementations just puke. And Nat as well. Nat, once again. Testing from both, routing from both, the trusted network to untrusted and untrusted to trusted and everything in between. Also firing directly at the untrusted interface of the firewall and at the trusted interface of the firewall as well can yield some different results. And also before, like I said, try all kinds of different configurations, one with a deny, one with an allow, two denies, two allows, and absorb, whatever. So here's the example. TCPSIC-S, which is the specifies the source IP, RAND. If you specify RAND, it will pick a random IP for every single packet it sends out. It's pretty cool. Sometimes, though, you don't want to do that because the firewall will just drop things that, like, if you're testing from the trusted network to an untrusted network, for instance. I'll do questions at the end. If you're testing from the trusted network to an untrusted network and you aren't sending from the subnet of the untrusted network, the firewall will be smart enough to just drop your packet and you won't go all the way through the code paths that you need to test them properly. So -srand is a good way to do things. When you use -srand, unplug yourself from the public internet. All right? When you send packets at a host, it's going to reply back to the source address, right? And if you hit some .mil by accident or something, and people come knocking on your door, that's why, all right? Especially when you're using ESIC, because ESIC by default sends to the broadcast Ethernet address. It kills networks, okay? If you can hide a laptop somewhere running ESIC that's broadcasting, that's sending like Ethernet frames to the broadcast address, you will kill a network. That's not really legitimate testing, though. That's just an aside. And then -d is the destination, trusted, so if we're going from untrusted. And be sure to set your random seed. If you don't set it, it uses the process ID of what it's running as right now. And so when you don't use -r, like your PID is incremental or random in OpenBSD or whatever, you won't get consistent results. And I've seen this mistake happen with people who didn't understand the tool, basically. They did -srand -d trusted, and then they just went to town. And then, like, they got something to crash. And then they could never get it to crash again. I'm like, well, what was your random seed? I don't know. Well. Oh, well. So I usually use 3337 or 666, something that's really dumb and easy to remember. If you can't get, like, anything to happen in, like, the first 5 million packets or so, try changing the random seed to something else. -M700 limits, it's like the maximum amount of packets you can pump out on the network, kilobytes per second wise. Now, like the next point says, Linux sends packets fucking fast, like 4 meg per second, really fast. But as we mentioned in our NetBSD advisory, Linux mangles packets and doesn't tell you. And so when we were doing some last-minute like testing to make sure this was completely reproducible right before we released the advisory, we couldn't reproduce it on Linux, and we were like, what the fuck is going on? And so we tested it from BSD. It worked. Problem with BSD is that because for whatever architectural reason, it's a lot slower at sending packets. It has these things called NMB clusters that fill up very fast for whatever reason. So you can't send them as fast. If you send them as fast, it will drop packets. So instead of sending mangled packets, you just don't send the packets at all. And this can be a problem. So -M700, when we were sending from some ARM32 boxes running NetBSD, and also from OpenBSD on like some Pentium 2s or something, that seemed to be about right. And I don't think it has anything to do with how fast the machine is. I think it has to do with the drivers and how they were written. And if you run into that, if your machine's slow or whatever, you can increase NMB clusters. Don't ask me how. I don't know anything about Unix. So the URL for ISIC, the suite of utilities, is http://expert.cc.purdue.edu/\FRANTZEN. That man's last name right there. So expert.cc.purdue.edu. /Tilda Friends. And so that's slide 8. Next, please. I was kind of a code example, by the way, but it's got lost in the ether, so I can't do it. So this is only loosely related, but as far as like the point of this is like this kind of testing like brings about certain problems with memory allocation, not checking syscalls, not checking the return values of syscalls, various other problems. So just some suggestions for dev managers, for whatever else. For the love of Christ, don't just start coding if you're going to do something serious. All right, if you're going to write like a 200-line program, fine. Like, get stoned drunk and like code until your fingers bleed. But if you're going to do something serious, define your interfaces first, plan first. Try and maintain consistency in the interfaces. God, it drives me crazy. I really, really hate code that's just a total rat's nest. There's no consistency at all. So this is always a good idea. And if you're in a professional environment, modeling tools like UML. What else, Aaron? UML. Like Rational Rows, whatever, can maybe help you if you're into that kind of thing. Writing clean, well-documented code, I mean, like, well-formatted, like, you can read it, good comments, stuff like that, will save you time and aneurysms later. A lot of people think it's a waste of time. A lot of managers think, no, you know, we don't have time to clean it up, whatever. It will always bite you in the ass, every single time. When you think the code is going to be used for 3 months and you're going to rewrite it, it's going to last 3 years, every single time. Have never seen it not happen. All right, this is a real pet peeve. All right, anybody tried to compile Nmap like 2.08 or like Nmap anything pre-2.5? And there was a zillion warnings complaining about all kinds of crazy shit, and all of it, most of it ended up being bugs. Linux, GNU, not so much BSD, like GNU programmers do this all the time, where like the compiler gives you warnings for a reason, okay? It's not telling you just for like, you know, to fill up your screen with crap. Please fix warnings if you see them. It's like the most simple thing that's overlooked every single time. Another thing is source and runtime analysis tools. If you have the loads and loads of cash to spend on Purify and Ensure++ and Flexcellent and stuff like that. If anyone wants to talk to me further about this stuff, I can talk about it at great length. But it has nothing to do with what we're talking about next. Code was supposed to be here. No, go back. I'm going to embellish my lameness for a minute. Code's supposed to be here, and I was going to like ask the crowd for to tell me what was wrong with it. And so I'll put it up on the New Hack page, or off my page off of New Hack, and along with these slides, and hopefully a recording of the talk. And y'all can send me mail saying like what you see, be like, where's Waldo? Of lame coding. And what I was going to do was, for every guess someone got right of what was wrong, I was going to hand out a shirt. So I'm going to hand out shirts during the Q&A instead for people who have really good questions. Next. For designers, designers and coders, if you're implementing on NT and you're interested in application level stuff, use TDI. Transport something interface. I can't remember what it is. Transport data? Driver. Transport driver interface. Thank you. You get stuff pre-IP assembled. So you don't have to duplicate work of the IP stack and further slow your IDS down. However, comma, this only works on host-based IDSs, which could be argued are the only IDSs that really work. But And it works on Windows 95, 98, whatever, NT and Win2K. So if you write code, it's going to be portable for the most part. The other thing you can use, I didn't mention here on the slide, is IP helper functionality is kind of interesting. Instead of like seeing, maintaining your own state table, just use the OSs. In Windows 98 and NT starting with Service Pack 4, NT 4.0 starting with Service Pack 4, these IP helper functions where you can actually get the connection table. You can see who's connected and not have to deal with maintaining your own state and duplicating more work. And if you do this, you're just going to be faster and you're just not duplicating work. So because you're not duplicating code, you're not going to like implement mistakes all over again, et cetera, et cetera. And in Linux 2.4, you can use netfilter interfaces. Like the Linux kernel actually has proper interfaces for something, if you can fathom such a thing. You can use the netfilter interfaces to wedge yourself at whatever point in the stack you want to get data, much like TDI / NDIS on Windows. And this is what I highly recommend. I wouldn't bother re-implementing IPFrag reassembly, TCP stream reassembly. It's just dumb, okay? Seriously, okay? Because when you re-implement things, that was the other thing. Don't re-implement things, okay? Don't rewrite libc calls. It's stupid. All right? When you write code, you're going to make mistakes. When you rewrite code that's existed for 10 to 15 plus years, right? It's been around for that long. People have probably found a lot of the bugs, right? People aren't going to find the bugs that are in your shitty code. Don't rewrite libc calls. If someone can argue with me later and prove me wrong on this, great. I'd really like to be proven wrong. Right now, it just annoys the shit out of me that things take three times as long just because someone has to rewrite snprintf. And also, when you're doing NAT and IPStack stuff, use the free stuff. There's no reason not to. Try and find someone else who has a NAT implementation like Cisco. Like everyone in the world used Cisco's first like basic reference implementation of IPsec and ISACAMP, and that's why they're all vulnerable to UDP garbage appendage bugs. But if it's mature code and you're reusing it, that's a good thing. You aren't wasting time. It's a really good thing. I can't stress this enough. If you have to argue with your manager about it, tell him send me mail. I'll gladly argue. This is something I love arguing about. So there's a New Hack City webpage, www.newhackcity.net. There is not a whole heck of a lot there right now, but I'm sure there will be in the future. Be able to buy various memorabilia, bongs, etc. And that's my email address, syke@newhackcity.net, newhackcity.net. And that's it. So Q&A.
If you're running Isaac and it sends like 5 million packets at your IDS and one of them crashes it, how do you narrow down which one did it?
Excellent question. That's something I overlooked and I forgot to add in. Isaac has two options, -p, which says send this many packets, and -k, which says skip this many packets. Mike should really be doing a talk on Isaac at this con. And so what you do is don't let it run overnight. Like try and pay attention, like look every 500,000 packets or something and see if it crashes. JRue actually wrote a patch that pinged after every so many packets. And I think maybe it was Mike told me someone like wrote a shell script or something that would send X number of packets, ping the host, and then like, you know, sort of incrementally go. Huh? Okay. He says there's one included in the tarball. So if you get the, if you go to the webpage, expert.cc.purdue.edu/FRANTZEN, it's in the tarball. But to answer your question so that you understand what's going on. So what you do is like, you know it crashed sometime between packets, 2.5 million and 3 million, sake of argument. So what you do is you do Isaac-S whatever, -D whatever, -R whatever, and then you do -P for sending, and you say -P send 3 million packets, and you say -K skip the first 2.5 million. When it skips packets, it takes a really long time because it has to go through with the random thing so you get the same results if you use the same random seed. And then from there, you just do binary search. If it crashes again, just say, fucking A, it's reproducible. Otherwise, you know, you expand your search a bit. And so once you have the range, you know the range, just start doing a binary search. And you say, okay, it's between 2.5 million and 3 million, right? If that doesn't do it, then you know what's the other half, and then you just like narrow it down. And it took me hour and a half to 2 hours to do that with a NetBSD exploit. Except I was lucky there where it didn't happen at 3 million packets. It happened at like 30,000 something. So that's how you do that. That's an excellent question. You get a T-shirt. There you go. Anybody else? Mr. Bauckham, would you like to come up and... How many? He said, how many intrusion detection systems did you test? With Whisker? With all these tools? We tested them. 5? 5? Professionally or in my spare time? Huh? Together? 7. Huh? I really don't want to... I would rather not advocate anything. I don't work for a vendor anymore, by the way. As I'm sure you will all find out, you get burnt out on this crap after a while, and you just don't want to deal with it anymore. That's why I'm doing this, so people can test this stuff themselves, so admins can go. If a vendor says, it detects everything under the planet, you know, and then you can test for yourself. And if you really feel like it, you can post a bug track and get your 255 TTLs of fame. So that's part of the reason for this talk. I wanted to do this. So to enable people to do this themselves. Yes? Yes, what's the most common problem? For the ones I've looked at code for, not checking system and library calls. Not checking mallocs. In all honesty, I am not really a programmer. I just play one on TV. So I'm sure there are more complex problems to be found, like linked list management, I think, was another one. That's a big problem, especially in NAT in the state table implementations. And NAT and packet filtering based firewalls and on IDSs that do things like that. Check your mallocs. Check for null pointers. Check for null pointers when you pass them into a function. Especially if you're writing code someone else is going to reuse. Paranoid is always best, right? The machines are fast enough, all right, to handle a CMP instruction. Anybody else? Yes? Yes, I can play advocate here. It depends on... There's two schools of thought in sort of source code and runtime analysis. There's source code analysis and runtime analysis. You have things like your preprocessor to do some source code analysis for you. There's lint, which hasn't been updated in ages, isn't ANSI/C compliant, and will give you all kinds of shit that doesn't matter. There's an updated lint by Gimple Software. They advertise in Dr. Dobbs Journal all the time. And that's gimple.com, G-I-M-P-E-L.com. And they have a thing called PC Lint, which is an executable that runs on Win32, DOS, OS2, et cetera, and it's pretty badass as a pure just source code analysis tool. And there's another one called, and it actually runs under Wine, which is what I do when I'm looking at Linux and BSD stuff. It runs under Wine, just fine. It's just a command line tool. And there's also another version called Flexilint, which actually you get the source code for under a special license, and then you just compile it on anything that has a KNRC compliant compiler. Yes? Do what? Oh, I'm not done yet. Okay. for runtime tools, I've used Purify and I've used Ensure++. The only ones available on Linux is Ensure++ that I'm aware of. They're all really expensive. Be prepared to... I don't advocate piracy, but pirate it or pay through the nose. And coincidentally, there are serial number generators and serial numbers for all those things on Asa La Vista. Purify is made by Rational Software. They're at www.rational.com. And and Ensure++ is Parasoft, and they're at www.parasoft.com. Ensure++ for Linux costs $4,000. It finds neat stuff, though, but their UI sucks. I like Purify's UI better, but that's it for that. Someone over here? You? Through a lot of frustration and pulling hair out, basically. We were making really, really sure that this was a real vulnerability, even after NetBSD, the NetBSD people told us, you know, what the problem was and everything else. They were really cool about it, by the way. Oh, and FreeBSD released an advisory that fixed the same problem, but they didn't credit us. And then they re-released the advisory and still didn't credit us, even after I mailed them saying credit us. So fuck FreeBSD. Oh, mangled packets. If you can't reproduce it, if it's not reproducible, sniff the wire, which is what we ended up doing. And we were like, wait a minute, like, this is shorter. Basically, it ended up being a short packet. It was the same length, and you're just looking at hex. It's like, whatever. Thankfully, we had already narrowed it down to a packet when we reproduced it. So we already had one packet, and we had to sniff for one packet. If you actually had to sniff and look at umpteen packets. I'm sure you could script it to make it automated, but this will still be a pain in the ass. But yeah, just TCP dump. Yes? Interesting question. There's as far as performance profiling, there's GProf, which some people say the output of which is useless. Some people say it's good. I don't know. There's Electric Fence, which some people like. It doesn't do all the stuff that Purify does. Purify does like API checking and all kinds of really cool stuff. I really like Purify. I'm a big rational advocate. I should be their cheerleader. There is a program on GNU.org. If you look in the FTP, I can't remember what it's called right now, but it only works on Linux 2.0.something and segfaults all the time. And it doesn't work. Like, it segfaults when it tries to load. And it works a lot like Electric Fence does. So that's not particularly useful. So to answer your question, no. I don't know of any free ones. I wish someone would get Flexilent and sort of like recode the interesting bits into a preprocessor. But actually, GCC 295.2, the whole 29X series, has some really cool checks in the preprocessor. So once again, pay attention to your warnings. Just, you know, turn on all your warnings and go to town. Okay. One more question? Yep. How well they work at. So the question was for IDSs or URL scrubbers that go through log files, for instance? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, there's already holes in those because IIS, when you give it a hexadecimal value, a percent code that is invalid, it doesn't drop it or whatever. It translates it into something else. And a couple of other web servers do the same thing but differently. We're like, so Snort will only really work on some systems for that. And the question was for URL normalization, like when you do like the URL encoding with the percents and whatever, like some IDSs like Snort, I'm sure there are several other IDSs. I think if Robert Graham from Network ICE was slamming someone else for not doing it, I'm sure he does it in his product. Because that would only make sense. No, I mean, yes and no. I mean, all that you can, I think Al Huger said once, said it best, he said, you can only raise the bar, which is all you can ever really do. And Hugh Daniels said the same thing with IPsec. Like with IPsec, you know, with these ciphers and whatever, we can only like do our best. And that's all you can ever really do, because if people want to own you, they're going to own you, period. All right, one really last question, yes? How do you find Snort compared to commercial in general? When you're testing? He's the Snort expert, actually. Luis, you want to answer a Snort question? He'll answer it at the end of his talk. I have only seen it on the screen when he was doing some testing. I don't know.
One really last one? Really last one? Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong. Which game is this?
It can use head or post or a bunch of other things, actually, if memory serves. And actually, that's an evasion technique, and that I don't think it'll work on getting through HTTP proxies, because they only look at the URL part. They don't care what you're doing, if you're getting or posting or anything. But as far as IDS is concerned, yes, a post will sometimes get past an IDS as opposed to a get. Have seen it happen. Is that your question? Mm-hmm. Say that again, I'm sorry.
All you need to do is to run like an code and a
Well, except that sometimes people do heads legitimately. Yeah. What he's saying was that you could write an encode filter for NFR that will look for heads, and so you'll see whisker scans effectively. Well, you could also look for like an abnormal amount of percents in a URL. You could do it a whole lot of ways. But really, what you really want to do, what you really want your IDS to do, is you don't want to figure out by hand what the fuck this translates to. You want to have it do it itself, so that when someone's owning you at 3 o'clock in the morning, you get paged. So I think like looking for a head or looking for percents or looking for whatever, which is legitimate. I see tilde get translated percent 2f all the time. Yeah, you'd want the IDS to interpret it just like the web server would. You want to know when you're getting owned so that you can, like, rush to the office, go, like, replace the Nazi pornography that's now on your website with your legitimate stuff before any customers see it at 5 a.m. That's what it comes down to. And that's all people really care about for the most part. All right, that's it. Thanks.